right, welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again to wrap up Season 39, Island of the Idols, and I suppose actually to immediately date this podcast, we are also going to be wrapping up just the year 2019 today, Dom. It is, at the time of this recording, December, I guess, 31st. I was struggling to come up with the final month in the year, so not off to a great start here. But we are back to get into everything that we saw play out a couple of weeks ago and probably have a larger conversation about just the state of Survivor in the year 2019. So with this preamble out of the way, Dom, how are you doing?
I'm not doing too bad. This is also the last episode of the 2010s, or of the decade, if you're that way inclined. It's been a long decade, and for most of it, a pretty interesting one. This year has been a little bit hit and miss, but we're outside that tunnel now, and next year is going to be really exciting. We have season 40 coming down the pipeline. We have Australian Survivor All-Stars, a ton of other good stuff to look forward to. But it's worth getting this out of the way and getting some closure on it first.
Yeah, look at you, Mr. Brightside, coming in here today. I love to see it. I am definitely with that. I think we have a lot to be looking forward to in 2020. And I would say to anyone who is potentially new to the podcast and somehow this is their first time hearing us, probably go ahead and just skip this episode and scroll down a bit in the feed and dive into one of the many podcasts we've already done about season 40. I think that would probably be a more enjoyable place to start. But Dom, let's get into this finale and just kind of season in review here for season 39. And we begin live in LA. Check that, not live, as we found out and may have talked about in our podcast leading up to this finale. We found out relatively recently, I think, before the finale was actually set to air, that it would not be done live, as has been the case, I believe, ever since season 2, going all the way back to 2001. For the first time since then, we were going to be on like a live to tape situation, and it was done a little earlier in the afternoon. As far as I could tell, there wasn't a very noticeable difference in terms of the viewing experience, and I haven't heard anything about whatever got cut out or anything like that. But what did you think about the effect of this taped finale, if you felt there even was a noticeable effect?
I didn't really notice one, and I guess that maybe is for the better, right, if they're able to pull this off seamlessly. I do wonder, though, going ahead, if this is one of those times where now that they were forced into doing it this time, and they see how it played out, they actually kind of like how it went, and they might consider doing this as their routine going ahead. But hopefully, if that's not the case, we don't have any cause to revisit this setup in the future.
Yeah, I would guess this will not be the routine going forward, even if they did find it slightly easier for a couple of different reasons. I would imagine they just wouldn't love the idea of the winner being officially out there so early, even though I don't know if there was anything floating around Twitter or Reddit or wherever else. I was not spoiled by anyone who attended the finale and broke whatever NDA they signed or anything like that. And I, as far as I know, that wasn't much of an issue on the day of the finale, but could be wrong there. But either way, I would imagine they are going to go back to the live finale. But regardless, let's get into the actual goings on here. Go ahead.
Well, quickly, I don't know how much of the refreshing lack of spoilers was due to everyone basically knowing the outcome already.
Yeah.
And it's not worth your time. Like, you don't get any pat on the backs for correctly anticipating that Tommy was going to win, right? Whereas I have visions of, let's say, the Ghost Island finale was live to tape instead, and someone on Reddit just has an inkling that maybe it's going to come down to the first tiebreaker in Survivor history and that Wendell's going to edge it out by one vote or something. Like, I could very easily see that. But when the spoiled people and the non-spoiled people already are on the same page for what's going to happen, then what's the point, really?
Right. I would guess the situation may have been drastically different if it had been last season that taped a bit early, and Chris coming out of absolutely nowhere to win was the result people had to keep secret. I could have seen that being potentially a bit more newsworthy, yeah, but hopefully not going to be an issue going forward. Actually, and the one other thing I wanted to note from this just opening intro while they're on the set in LA is when Jeff brings out the final five, I did think it was noteworthy because I wasn't sure how this was going to go, but he introduces each of them one at a time, and Tommy is the last person he introduces, and Tommy clearly gets by far the biggest reaction from the audience. So I thought that was at least noteworthy because I wasn't super confident in how the casual fan was really feeling about the players entering this finale. Like, it wouldn't have surprised me at all to find out that Tommy was the, like, heavy casual front runner, but it also wouldn't have surprised me if the average casual was not that invested in Tommy just because he's been kind of a lower profile personality, I would say, despite getting a lot of visibility. So I did think that was interesting.
Let's keep in mind that this isn't a casual audience. This is an audience which has gone out of their way to acquire tickets for the Survivor finale taping. So we don't know how many casuals are really going to be among that crowd. But yeah, it's tough to predict really how Tommy would be received because he doesn't fit the profile for a winner, and especially for a male winner in modern day Survivor, where they're just constantly making big moves and bigging themselves up all the time, and they're these big, imposing characters. Tommy was just kind of like the default choice almost. He's the guy who the people in the game didn't respect enough to take him seriously as a threat. And then, you know, he doesn't give the cameras too much to work with either. He's not this massive, big personality to compensate for that. So, yeah, I could see there just being this total lack of enthusiasm around Tommy. But maybe it's the lack of enthusiasm for the season that maybe buoys up Tommy here, where if everything else feels so kind of negative and such a slog, having someone who just could not possibly be construed as offensive is really what you need to make that easier to swallow.
How much of Tommy's arc on this season do you think had to do with all of the ugliness, to just kind of bundle everything together, that went on around him? Where, and I mean that in the sense of, like, how careful do you feel like they were to make sure the winner was as agreeable as possible versus they may have handled Tommy a little differently under different circumstances? Do you think there is anything to that idea?
I think it may be overdetermined, where that was always going to be how the winner was going to be portrayed, but it's also the only way that Tommy could ever be portrayed because of who he is. And that's the same quality which leads him to having this allegedly great social game, right? It's that what could you possibly have to say bad about Tommy? And versus, like, let's say Lauren wins that fire challenge, gets into the finals and ends up winning. Her personality is much bigger, much larger. She's played a more prominent role in the season. So that could go any number of ways. Like, maybe you do the same thing where you just kind of sand down any rough edges of her personality to make her as agreeable as possible. Or you just let Lauren be Lauren, and hopefully the audience takes well to that.
The one thing that you just said that I would take issue with is that Tommy could never come across any other way. I do agree that Tommy does seem like sincerely a super sincere, or like a genuine and smart game playing kind of guy who would generally do very well out there, and that is going to often lend itself to looking good on the TV episodes as well, of course. But I also think in timelines where he doesn't actually end up winning the game, and particularly in timelines where he gets blindsided in one capacity or another, I definitely don't think it is the case that we would still just see this constantly glowing version of Tommy. I think they could easily make him look like kind of a goofball if they wanted to.
Oh, I mean, the timelines where Tommy wins, he always looks like this. Yeah, there's always an element of, like, sink or swim, where even the best players, if it serves the narrative, could be made to look like a doofus if that's the path of least resistance. For sure.
Right. I think we're going to show up to season 40 and see, I don't know who it's going to be, but we're going to see some very different sides of people that looked really good the first time or whenever they won.
Yeah, and that's something that I think goes understated in all of the excitement around season 40. And I understand it because, you want to focus on the positive, you want to get hyped up, get excited, and root for your favorites. But there are, it is a good problem to have. There are so many people to cheer for and to just be intrigued to see how they play on that season. And some of them are going to disappoint. And for some of those, it's going to be, well, I came back, I tried my best, and it didn't work out. But because of that, they're going to be edited to be given much less credit than they plausibly deserve, to the point where that's going to overwhelm any residual respect you might have had from them on their first season. So this will give life to that maxim of never meet your heroes, because mm-hmm. some of your heroes are going to be voted out third and you'll never hear a peep from them again.
Yeah. Well, the one person who I think is very excited about that prospect, at least as far as I have heard, is Stephen Fishpack, has been openly rooting for the opportunity to see these people finally get some comeuppance. Like, even before they were all back and everything, I remember, like, his first reaction to finding out that this season was even happening is, I'm so excited to watch 19 of these people finally lose.
Yeah, I'm sure he's very excited to watch and cheer on Sophie, for instance, and also very excited to watch Sophie crash and burn, possibly, if that ends up happening too. So it's really a win-win from his perspective.
Yeah, I definitely am going to be paying close attention kind of tracking closely the willingness to diminish the reputations of some of the historically more revered winners as things start to play out on season 40. And I think that actually kind of ties in nicely to the place I want to start here with this season 39 finale, which is with Rob and Sandra, who are going to make their final appearance here in this season. The finale opens with them hanging out on top of this cliff, talking about everything Survivor has given to them over the years. And Dom, within 7 minutes of this finale beginning, Rob and Sandra are just boated out of here, and that's it for them until the reunion, which I thought was really surprising. And it brought me, the whole journey this season, my big question, I think, that it has led me to is what the editors were really going for with Rob and Sandra, because I was certainly of the opinion that pretty much whatever they said was going to be viewed as gospel and they would be the ones officially endorsing the winner and making us feel good about that person winning. And as things turned out, half the people who went to visit Rob and Sandra were immediately screwed over by whatever lesson they just got. And the one guy who never had to interact with them in any kind of game capacity is the one who ended up taking it down in a pretty commanding fashion here. And on top of Rob and Sandra discussing what a lock it was that a woman has to win this season, I really am wondering, were they made to look kind of dumb in retrospect the whole time? Like, are even Rob and Sandra in jeopardy now entering season 40 if this is how they're getting treated when they're the sharks among minnows?
Yeah, joke's on me for declaring with utmost confidence that, of course, Rob and Sandra were going to end up on the jury and play a massive role in the finale. But we can just sweep that one under the rug. We had this discussion a while back of, like, what does the edit that Rob and Sandra receive imply about season 40? And the prognosis there, maybe it's not so good, honestly. It was almost as if Rob and Sandra were like the proud, doddering old teacher or whatever who kind of shows up to see their students overachieve, as opposed to the real authority figures that we all imagine they would be.
Right, and I know there are going to be the bad faith arguers who are hearing you say that and think we are saying, or want to believe that we are saying, oh, based on their edit in season 39, done chain on Rob and Sandra in season 40, write them off. Edgic is all that matters. And that is not even close to the case, but it does seem like not nothing that in retrospect, now seeing how all of this played out, I have a hard time feeling like they really gave Rob and Sandra the hero treatment that I definitely was expecting the entire way there. And I don't know how often that would happen if one of them just went out there and crushed season 40 and is going to look awesome again 2 months from now.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing which we will look back after season 40, after knowing what Rob and Sandra's fates really are, and that's going to be so far down the list of things to discuss. But right now, that's really all we have to talk about. So it's tempting to like sink our teeth into it as much as we can.
Yeah. Well, I loved in this kind of closing scene from Rob and Sandra, first of all, the disparity between Rob talking about how, you know, this has been two of the most meaningful decades of my life. I've met my wife here. We've had four kids together. We've both won the game. And Sandra's like, yeah, I really just enjoy the money. I could take or leave pretty much everything else, which I thought was perfect for both of them. And then also Rob saying, and this is exactly what I'm talking about, in terms of the editors almost seemingly like messing with him, right? Where they leave in this quote of him saying, the island was intended to make people better Survivor players, and I hope that for the people who visited us, that was the case, as we are about to go on to watch, as I mentioned, the one guy who was lucky enough to stay away go on to win here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so just kind of an overall weird ending to the Robin Sandra of it all this season for me. On top, I mean, maybe that's exactly what I should have expected after how weird the first 13 episodes of Robin Sandra were, but I thought that was at least noteworthy, is how all of this kind of came to a close. And before they head out, they do give these people their parting gift of commemorative Final Five buffs, these collector edition Survivor buffs, Dom, that Tommy is quickly able to deduce contain a clue. They reference before they get into their boat that there are many gifts that the island still has to give to them. And Tommy, the guy who never had a lesson from Robin Sandra in the first place, is the one to piece together that probably means there is something for them still here to find. So Tommy is going to have his whole scavenger hunt and bring Dean in on that. But quickly before we get into that, one other note on just Tommy and the Robin Sandra reveal is when everyone gets boated over, it really seemed like Tommy knew exactly what he was, what to expect there, right? Like for the first time, it definitely did seem like he absolutely knew that Rob and Sandra were right around the corner.
Yeah, for sure. Although he is also someone who is not that emotive and mostly takes things in his stride. So I could see him just not giving too much away. But yeah, I'm sure. I don't know who exactly would have let him in on the joke. Maybe someone who had been there themselves or the producers or whatever. But either way, it felt like he knew what the deal was, even though, as has been mentioned time and time again, he is the one person who does not end up enjoying the benefits of their wisdom. Which I don't know what that's meant to mean officially for the story of the season, right? When if Rob and Sandra are the ones who are making people better Survivor players, is Tommy just leagues above all of them to the point where he doesn't even need their advice? Or is it just further confirmation that twist is a busted flush? It's not going to really affect the outcome.
I think the true lesson here, Dom, is you don't need advice on Survivor. Think for yourself. Be your own player. Steer your own ship, and that is the recipe for success.
It feels like there are easier ways of doing that than the whole Island of the Idols setup, but sure, it's good to have that confirmed.
Yeah, well, Tommy is colorblind, we find out, so he gets the first clue to the idol once he pieces together that there's a machete on these commemorative buffs that wasn't there on the original buffs. He starts looking around for machetes and finds a coconut filled with pink paint, and only pink paint, so he knows that the next thing he needs to look for is whatever is pink, but that's a little more difficult when you can't really distinguish between pink and red and orange and anything like that. So he brings Dean in to this mission, which I found somewhat surprising, just given that this is presumably the last idol of the game. It is so valuable. I would not personally want to run the risk of someone else getting to this idol before I do if I think I'm the only one onto this trail of clues. But again, I am not the colorblind one here, and Tommy is, yeah. And I could certainly imagine that he felt like he had no choice.
He may also be thinking that if his position is good enough, it's more important that he keep it out of the wrong person's hands than that he hold it specifically himself. And so if he trusts Dean enough, and he just needs to make sure that, like, Janet doesn't have two idols or something, which I don't know how that works with the idol nullifier. Like, would she have to play the second one preemptively, or do we even have any idea on that?
I would imagine because of the order of operations here, if Janet had two idols, this is what I would guess would happen. She goes and plays her first idol. Jeff says, this is a hidden immunity idol. He then says, and this is a hidden immunity idol nullifier. I think at that point, she would still now have time before the votes are read to go play her second idol. So I would guess, although I do not know for sure, that that is how it would go down.
Maybe just one nullifier voids all idols, which would, I guess, make it even more powerful. But regardless, I touch wood, we're never going to see that come up at all. But
by the way, it absolutely not would be my ruling on a nullifier, this person.
Yeah, okay, we get that. But I do wonder if the challenge team had to take into account Tommy's colorblindness on the season. Like, I don't have any vivid memories of the earlier challenges, mostly because they were all the exact same challenge for like 7 weeks in a row. but for instance, if part of that challenge involves you have to dive into the ocean, retrieve your tribe's bag of puzzle pieces or something, if Tommy can't distinguish between those bags because he just can't see the colors, then that seems like a detriment to him that's unfair. So I don't know if that's just something that they treat as in the same vein as, well, this person can't run as fast, so that's going to hinder them in the challenges too. What do you expect us to do about it? Or if there's some kind of like fairness consideration in how that comes into play, which makes them have to rework things.
I don't think they really care about who is good or bad at swimming when they are deciding whether or not to do water challenges. But I would also say it is super rare, if not something that has never happened before, where the two different tribes will have buffs that are really similar colors. And so I would imagine during any kind of get your tribe's puzzle pieces, it's pretty easy for Tommy to distinguish between orange and blue or whatever, orange and purple or whatever it was, or red and blue or whatever it would be on any given season. What I would be concerned about with a colorblind person running a challenge would be in the individual kind of obstacle course challenges, where you do several different phases and everyone has their own assigned color. I would then be nervous about running the risk of one person's the red panels and one person's the orange puzzle pieces and whatever, and him getting the wrong bag there or going to the wrong person's station or whatever. But either way.
Look, the only way to keep this fair is for every challenge to be a blindfold challenge.
Well, Dom, let's go back to Dean here with his assist from Tommy now being in on this hunt for the idol, and he is going to color blindside Tommy by coming away with it here. Thank you. Hold for laughs, I guess, where Dean is going to do the crucial math of the swing being important, and he finds it right around there and has an idol for himself now at Final Five on top of the idol nullifier he got last week, and also now is going to come away here with the Final Five immunity necklace. So Dean is very blinged out, as he puts it here, at this Final Five round, and this seems to be his big kind of argument when it comes around at Final Tribal Council, the outplay portion, whatever. I think outwit is social game. I'm not sure if outplay is physical or outlast is advantages or vice versa or whatever it is. Dean makes a very big deal about how much power he had in this particular round. And while it's obviously not going to go his way ultimately this season, this sort of thing is almost identical to the argument that Chris Underwood was making at the previous Final Tribal Council, which is essentially, like it or not, the end game on Survivor is often dictated by exactly this sort of thing, and the game is constantly evolving, and what better way to sign off on that than to vote for me? And that seems to be almost exactly what Dean was going for as well. So as far as you're concerned, Dom, is Survivor at the point where this is just part of it now and we are the idiots for not taking that more into consideration?
Taking it into consideration how?
like, if we were jurors, I do not think we would be particularly receptive to the arguments that Dean is making or the arguments that Chris would have made last season compared to Tommy or, you know, in season 39's case, or Gavin last season playing a really solid social strategic game the entire way. But I think there is a large school of thought, and I think, if you know, obviously one of these juries came back overwhelmingly in favor of the out, whatever outplay or outlast portion it is that deals with the advantages and so forth, and just kind of the modern survivor element of things falling from the sky being really meaningful and playing a major role in how people's games should be judged.
Yeah, I think with that, you have to be the lack of change that you want to see in the world, I guess, where if you have certain values about what you respect in the game and who you want to see represent your season and who you're happy to call a winner, then you have to kind of follow those. And the fact that everyone else seems to be moving in a different direction shouldn't really sway you much, because they're not paying any attention to what you think, right? Like, they're, no one's checking in with you to see what you actually think of Dean's strategic prowess, right? They're just going on how well he did in the challenges, how well they like him, whether they respect him and the way he acted in the game. Like, people have their own criteria, and that's fine, but it seems weird to, like, sign over your agency to them when they're definitely not going to return the favor. I think maybe it's overstated how much that is going to matter in a season where we saw the guy who framed his earning, I guess, of advantages in, like, these world historical terms, where he said to the camera, like, if you don't think that me winning an advantage and winning immunity and such is part, a big part of survivor history that's going to be etched in the history books, then you're not a fan or whatever. I don't know how sincere that is. Maybe it's him needing to hype himself up and then coming to believe his own hype, but either way, that guy got very little respect from the jury compared to the one winner in so long now who didn't need any of that to get himself further. Now the fact that he is unique in that sense, that Tommy is bucking the trend, maybe speaks to how powerful that trend is. I don't know, but I don't think it's a completely lost cause just yet.
Okay, I agree with that. I think it is a little early to tell, and we have seen two results go pretty conclusively in opposite directions these last two seasons in terms of just how important that was. And maybe a big piece of that is the jurors on the Edge of Extinction season, you know, as we talked about in the moment, I think felt a lot more kind of personal validation in voting for Chris, the guy who went through the exact same thing they did and pulled off exactly what they wished they could have pulled off had they been the one to re-enter. And if they had done it, they should have won. So of course Chris should win. And that element was certainly not there, on season 39. So maybe it is, overstated just how much of an effect these, end game advantages and so forth, and how one plays them and accumulates them, may have on juries going forward. But I definitely think times are changing, and a big reason for that is I think Jeff Probst thinks this is all extremely important, and when he's the one moderating Final Tribal Council, and he is, for my money, strongly suggesting that the social game is one-third of Survivor, the physical game is one-third of Survivor, and how you deal with advantages and so forth is one-third of Survivor, I think we are only going to trend further in that direction.
Yeah, despite his best efforts, you will never have jurors grading on some, like, clear rubric, where I think, you know, you can say that the social portion is one-third of the game, but you are much more inclined to give fair respect to someone's challenge accomplishments or their strategic ability if you already like them and respect their game and want to like and respect their game.
I do just want to say, though, I mean, as far as I can tell, and sorry for cutting you off, but it seemed to have a very real effect. Like, Missy, I believe it was Missy, was explicitly saying when Tommy was talking about how strong his social game was, she says, okay, you have him on one out of three, what else?
Yeah, and that's the most explicit framing of it. But I think if you go back even before, I guess, Millennials versus Gen X would be when this trend really started. I think even before then, you had these signs of people trying to, like, demarcate. Okay, so you get 5 points in the social column, but maybe only 2 points in the challenge column. I think that's always been there, and it helps people to work through this really complicated multi-layer decision in their own minds. But yeah, I think the kind of point scoring that we saw from Missy is going to become a recurring theme here.
Yeah, and I also think, by the way, though, that when this is the narrative Jeff seems to want to push, and when the jurors are thinking in these terms, I thought Dean, whether he believed what he was saying or not, did do a really good job in trying to make the best case he could given his position, which is whether he personally thinks this is equally as important as the social game. All that matters is what the jury thinks. And he's, I think he did a really solid work here. He did really solid work here trying to sell them on the idea that this is a huge deal. And I totally crushed Tommy at this element of the game. And that means the social element he crushed me at is a complete wash, and everything comes down to whatever part three is. And I won two necklaces and he won zero. And so you got to vote for me. I really feel like Dean had, I would say, even a stronger final tribal council than Tommy did in terms of trying to sell what he had to sell. It just didn't work.
Yeah, and it was unfortunate for him that he was gaining so much momentum and looked like he was maybe swaying some people's minds, and then he just crashed headfirst into a brick wall with the Jamal legacy advantage thing, which, to his credit, he, and with an assist from some of the jurors, was able to spin into not a positive, but at least a kind of, you know, it wasn't just the end of his game automatically. But I think from that point, it was hard for him to really scrape any good case together.
Right. I mean, Jamal himself said, Dean, it happened to be fake, but to your credit, you did pull off the maneuver where if it was real, you would have had everyone off the scent, which is all that really matters.
Right.
And that's what we said in real time. And this, I think, was kind of a trend all season as far as I was concerned about Dean, particularly when it came to Boston Rob, was getting really undersold in terms of how good some of his ideas were, even if the result didn't end up going his way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So I guess we have to talk about it, Dom, this final five vote where it looks like everything's going to be okay for Janet. She has this idol. She is by far the best at making fire. She's already writing her final tribal council speech. And, of course, that's how you know everything's about to come crashing down. Janet gets up to play her idol, and she gets those horrifying words from Jeff Probst. This is a hidden immunity idol, and this is an idol nullifier. Dean has nullified Janet's idol, and that is going to be the end of her game here, exactly as we had all feared. That coin flip on Edge of Extinction, Island of the Idols, did end up being Janet's undoing, and obviously we don't know for sure, but I would guess that in the scenario where that coin lands on the other side, we could easily be looking at Janet as a survivor winner right now, Dom. So I guess give me your just kind of parting thoughts on Janet and how all of this unfolded from your perspective.
You could see on her face, it wasn't just the emotional swing of thinking that you'd got one over on the rest and kept yourself safe and you were getting yourself into this really good spot going into the final round to just being out of the game. It was also the sense of being robbed and unfairness that was etched all over her face. Like, you could tell she was thinking, this is bullshit. And it is. She's right. Like, yeah, there's no justification for this being in the game. And like, whenever you have a swingy twist like that, if you're on the receiving end, you can sometimes tell yourself, well, okay, obviously it screwed me over, but I understand that we are all here for a TV show to make good TV, and for a twist to be impactful, someone has to be hard done by from it. And maybe it's me in this case, so that makes sense. But here, like, this twist is not good TV, right? Like, who is sitting there thrilled that the idol nullifier got busted out, really hoping and rooting for Janet to go home? Nobody. And instead, this twist ruined what would have been a decent TV moment in and of itself, but also deprived us of maybe the one winner who narratively could redeem the season, and also someone who seemed to be a massive fan favorite in general, and certainly a big Sia favorite in general.
So I would like to check the tape on your thoughts on the idol nullifier when it was used against Dan the Hot Cop on David versus Goliath.
Well, I can tell you exactly what that tape will show. I said, okay, it's great like, this is the best possible outcome for the Idol Nullifier, and still, the fundamental concerns about its unfairness shouldn't be overlooked. And even though it's funny to see Dan get screwed over, is it that much better than the outcome where Dan successfully uses his idol in a way that no one really anticipated, maybe? So I don't know if you're trying to, like, suggest anything different, but I have been taking the same stance on this ever since its inception.
No, I certainly wasn't trying to say, oh, I remember what you said. I don't remember what you said. That's why I said I wanted to check the tape on what you said. But I am guessing it was not, oh, this is totally sense. What you are saying is ringing a bell, and I think that is roughly the page that I would come down on, which is what happened to Dan, as far as the producers would be concerned for the TV show, is almost exactly the best case scenario. And I would sign off on there being a lot of really bad scenarios, such as the one that we saw play out here on season 39, perhaps so many bad scenarios just in general that it would not make it worth having the Idol Nullifier in the first place. But I don't think I would be of the opinion that this is just something that never should have existed. I would have to, again, check the tape on this myself, but I would guess that I, you know, assuming you are right about your takes in the moment, that perhaps I was the one who was more okay with this existing in the first place. And while I would love to see it not be, I would love to see it, I guess, expire before Final Five, and something like this that would be a literal $1 million swing a huge percentage of the time be even on the table, it is still, to me, even seeing what happened to Janet, not necessarily something I would never want to see again. Are you just hard out on ever having a Nullifier back?
I just don't see the point. I don't see the upside, and I guess we did see the upside. We have the examples here now to weigh that up for ourselves, and I think the verdict is clear, at least for me.
Okay, and I would absolutely grant that based on the first two iterations of the Idol Nullifier being in play, it has been a tremendous net negative. I just am fundamentally of the opinion that something should at least be on the table in terms of counterplay around all of these idols that are just falling from the sky now every season.
Okay, but the way to do that, I think, is to draw that back instead of not only putting too many advantages in the game through the idols themselves, but then compounding that problem even further by trying to remedy that via another advantage. It just seems like you're really not addressing the issue there.
Why draw it back when we could ramp it up, Dom?
Yeah, I suppose.
We can get the same result with twice as many twists. It's perfect. What could possibly go wrong? But yeah, not going to go Janet's way here, unfortunately. But as you mentioned, she is going to get $100,000 from Sia in this season's Sia prize, and one of three people here actually to get the hookup. Elaine also gets $100,000, and Jamal gets $15,000 for Jamal, which I'm sure he's not going to be complaining about. But that was so weird, right? That it's only $15,000 next to two other $100,000s.
I don't know if this is like Sia's budget for her Survivor contributions getting low somehow, or if she honestly thought that Jamal was like exactly 15% as deserving as Elaine or Janet. I really want to be a fly on the wall when that conversation was happening.
I believe it is the case that the only increments she has ever given out are $15,000 and then $100,000, but I too would be very curious about the allotment process here. Not that I'm questioning her. I mean, she's certainly free to do whatever she wants in terms of giving, taking away from her own infinite wealth to help out those more in need. I am certainly not trying to talk her out of any of this. It seems hard not to have kind of a befuddled reaction to that kind of split.
It is a real steep pay jump, for sure. And it's like, if you are the Jamal in this situation, sitting there with your 15K, you have to wonder what you maybe could have done instead to get yourself that extra $85,000, which is a very solid payday, frankly, given the Survivor prize structure.
Yeah, certainly not bad. And I had speculated on Twitter that this Sia prize may be something, $100,000 if there are multiple cracks at this every season, as seems to be the case, there definitely may come a point where people recognize I am far better off playing to be in Sia's good graces than I am to try to get second place here, because I feel pretty capped at losing finalist.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that is going to be a prevailing strategy, but it wouldn't blow me. Like, we even saw explicitly Elaine at some point in the reunion was giving some answer to Jeff about how much better her life has been since Survivor and all that she's gotten from it. And then I know she was joking, but still, it was clearly weighing on her mind. Sia's about to give some money away here, and I need to make it clear to Sia it's not that great, though. I could definitely still use some help.
Yeah.
So it's definitely playing a role, at least in the reunions. Anyway, Dom, let's go back to tournament here, back to the main game. Nora is going to win our final four immunity, and she now has the decision of taking Tommy, Dean, or Lauren with her to the finals and sending the other two to fire. And of course, Nora does an amazing job of dragging this out for like half an hour to reveal to them what her decision is going to be. And we ultimately see, Dom, here that she has chosen to take Tommy, who seems to have convinced her that he is bad at fire making himself, and that Lauren is the big threat, and she needs to send Dean in there because Tommy's going to be hopeless, and they're both screwed anyway if Lauren makes the final. This really surprised me, to see Tommy end up being the one who was taken here. I may have just been blinded by the narrative on TV of Nora and Dean really seeming like the two more obvious frontrunners to be goats here entering this final. But I, for the last few weeks, have been at least thinking to myself, if not saying on air, I'd be pretty surprised if Nora and Dean didn't take each other if they won at Final Four.
So you thought this would be another case of Tommy basically playing a fire challenge for $1 million, effectively, or
yes,
winning that final immunity himself and bypassing the whole process, locking it up right there and then.
I was leaning much more towards one of Nora or Dean is going to win the challenge and take the other one, and Tommy and Lauren are going to play a fire challenge for $1 million.
And that would be a fitting end to their story, right? If they are the dominant duo of the game, it's rare these days that we see both members of that pair actually make it to the end. And part of that, I think, is because of this fire challenge setup, where if you're one member of that duo, it's so much more appealing to take an obvious go and at least give yourself the chance that person fails the fire challenge and gets rejected, gives you an easier path to the win. Whereas if you're not in that duo, then obviously you just take the other goat that's there, and okay, you're still probably going to lose to whichever one of them does win at fire, but at least you make that one rather than two. So it would make a lot of sense if it was Tommy versus Lauren heads up for $1 million, basically. But instead, Tommy just gets grandfathered in. And I guess then he has to sweat the fire challenge for $1 million, because the consensus seemed to be if Lauren made it to the end, she would have won. And I don't know how true that is, but it seems plausible based on everything we saw. And as far as I know, none of the people who have done interviews or any other content since the finale have contradicted that in any way. It seems like they're happy to go with the flow there.
Have people done interviews and postseason content after the fact? I've heard a little from like the red carpet on finale night, but
yeah, that's what I mean. Basically, I don't think we've really had any like deep dives or anything of that sort, and I'm not sure how many we will get, frankly, with this season. But as far as I know, Lauren would have won probably if she made it to the end, and the only exception would be if she had been up there against Janet or Elaine, who were the other two big contenders to win. And so that's why, understandably, people have focused on the Robin Sounder question and the infamous episode title of A Woman's Gonna Win This Season. And I'm curious to hear what you think about this, but to me, there's kind of a difference here between this case where, yeah, the winner is Tommy, who just swept it seemingly very easily, and some of the other cases over the past four seasons, which were also all won by men, where in most of those cases, there was not actually an alternate timeline or a viable alternative to that person winning, really, or at least one that would open the door in that discussion. So you go back to Ghost Island, for instance, where if it wasn't Wendell, it was going to be Dom. If it wasn't Dom, it was going to be Wendell. Angela Perkins is not coming out there to steal the crown for them anytime soon.
Who would have won David versus Goliath if Nick Wilson hadn't been an immunity hog?
Probably Mike White, I'm guessing, right? Like, it seemed like Kara was just not really respected by the jury members at all, despite what we were assuming based on the edit and everything. Yes, thank you. And then... Heroes, is it Heroes, Healers, Hustlers, 35. What, there we go. It was, the only question was, did Devon get screwed and not how could Chrissy have won instead, right? And there were no other women really in contention there. Whereas this time around, it felt like this was almost the only permutation of people in the mid to late game where not only would Tommy would have won, but where a woman was not going to win. So if it wasn't Tommy, it was going to be one of Lauren, Janet, or Elaine out of that final seven, final eight. And so I don't know how much that validates the claim that the Rob and Sandra were making, where it's like, yeah, this is the season where a woman was most likely to win of anyone in recent memory, and it just so happened that we hit that 10 or 15% instead, and Tommy takes home the crown. Or if you have more faith in Tommy and you think that his win had this kind of inevitability to it almost, where, yeah, of course he needed that exact permutation to win, but he knew that, and because of that, he was able to guide the game in that direction. He knew what he had to do in order to keep that door open, the same way that, yeah, of course Boss and Rob maybe had to go against exactly Natalie and Philip to win Redemption Island, but no one was surprised when that ended up happening, and in fact, anything else almost would have come as a surprise too. So I'm not sure where Tommy's win falls among that.
Yeah, it is interesting, and I do wonder, to go back to this final four decision from Nora's point of view, how clear of a picture she had of Tommy being a pretty runaway winner in the scenario where Lauren doesn't make it to the finals. And I do wonder if she knows that both Lauren is freaking out about the prospect of having to make fire. She hasn't made fire this entire time, clearly doesn't want to do it. And also, if Lauren loses fire, Tommy is going to win anyway. I do, and Nora is essentially then like a one-person juror. It wouldn't surprise me if she would change her decision and take Lauren instead, if she knew that she was more or less deciding the winner.
And that is going to determine Tommy's historical reception, I think, because if he would have lost to Lauren and Elaine and Janet, and in the ultimate hierarchy, he wasn't that well liked or respected, then I think that docks him a lot of points compared to if, you know, he would have won against most combinations and he just had to make it there and was able to convince someone to take him, which puts him in the contention for an all-time great, I would say.
I agree with that, and it is unfortunate that we haven't gotten to hear more about how all of that would have played out, and maybe we will down the line, although I am nervous that people may be ready to move on from this season and look ahead.
Please, yes.
More than look behind. So maybe we will never know. And honestly, Dom, just this is a thought I had just watching this finale back recently. And by that, I mean earlier today, when it has been, I think, all the way back since, like, the week Dan got pulled was the last time we talked about season 39. I guess over on the Patreon feed at patreon.com/Dom and Colin, I did do a bonus podcast talking a little bit about this with my great friend Casual Anna, a casual Survivor fan, to kind of hear from the people on the street about how they reacted to this finale. But when I was watching this again, it truly felt just so weird being back in the season 39 zone. The same way I would say in retrospect, it feels so weird to have spent, a year and a half of my life consecutively being really into and podcasting about Game Changers, HHH, and Ghost Island, like, all in a row. I can't believe I invested that much time into that. Like, in retrospect, I'm already at the point with 38 and 39 where I can't believe we just spent the last year talking about these seasons in so much depth, when I, even rewatching this finale for the first time, am already at the point where it's like, I'm so ready to just be done with these seasons from now until the time that Survivor is off the air. I'm ready to stop thinking about them.
I don't know how true this is for you, but I find that when you're so heavily immersed in one activity or one interest, it becomes easy to mark time via milestones in that compared to like actual calendar time or whatever. So if I think back to like what was happening in 2013 versus 2014, that is so hard to conceptualize that distance. Whereas if I think about it in terms of, oh yeah, this is when Caramon was airing, that feels like ages ago, or this is when San Juan del Sur was airing, which feels kind of recent-ish almost. That's maybe a cleaner way of conceptualizing that. And so the fact that, yeah, it's been like a full year since like we were raving over David versus Goliath and looking to the future with some measure of optimism. It's just so hard to, you know, like place that in any kind of historical context, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, I remember for sure things in terms of what Survivor seasons were airing and which apartment did I live in, because I've moved around a few times over these last couple of years. And absolutely, when I think like the only things I can really remember specifically from certain years is which apartment I was at and what Survivor seasons were airing. And that is kind of how I get my bearings for what was going on at that point in my life. That is without a doubt. The number one thing I think about is which Survivor season was airing, or which two seasons were airing in that year, and that is how I figure out what I was doing in my life.
Yeah, definitely.
No question about it, yeah. So, all right, we end up seeing Lauren and Dean here go to fire, and as I noted and kind of skipped over, Lauren in particular seemed really upset about having to go to fire and unprepared for that. Dean also said he hadn't made a fire the entire time he was out there. But Tommy, while telling Nora he couldn't make fire, it sounds like was secretly good at fire, which I definitely do want to give him credit for this. It definitely seems game theory optimal in this situation to use a super annoying poker term to add another one into the mix.
Listen, strong wings weak wings strong, okay? Yeah. That's what we're talking about here.
Equity, drawing dead, like, we need more poker terminology in Survivor. But it definitely seems like the right idea, Dom, to be really good at fire without being Janet and having everyone know that you are unbeatable in fire.
Look, I'm not kidding here when I say that you are the problem. You are the one who introduced equity to the Survivor vernacular, I think. Just, like, relentlessly hammering it into people's brains for the past 8 years. I think that's you. I think you blazed that trail.
So, as usual, I think with anything like that, it is, I began it and then people, Rob started using it because it is the correct way to think about things, and that is what made it popular. It's not me making it popular.
You walked so that Rob Cesternino could run.
Yes, he really owes it all to me. I'll take half of that Patreon money now, please and thank you. Yeah, so one other thought I had just on Final Four here, I'm guessing it wouldn't have made a huge difference, but just theoretically speaking, if you are Dean, coming off of two immunity wins, would you rather complete the immunity hog saga here and win this final immunity, or would you rather do the fire challenge?
I don't know. I think we still haven't fully figured out.
Or both. Why not both?
Well,
you can win the immunity and do the fire challenge.
You can get the whole experience. I think we just still don't have enough data, I guess, yet to judge how important that final win really is. Because it is the most important time in the game. It's the most recent one. So whatever recency bias that is going to solidly settle around that. And it gives you that momentum. And it is just the crowning achievement that you can hang your hat on. And if you've been playing a quiet game up until that point, I think the best case you can make at the end is, I turned it on, I won when it counted, and I was the one who controlled everyone else's fates here. I was the one who was able to drag person X to the finals with me. However, that also puts you in kind of a bind where, like, now it gives the threat that you want to lose in the fire challenge the ability to say, well, not only did I do X, Y, and Z that made me the threat to begin with, But now also, I was able to win my way there despite this person's best efforts, and often that is the trump card.
Yeah, I think over these last few seasons, we've obviously seen a lot of fire-making winners go on to win the game. And I certainly understand why, in particular, great friend of the podcast, Dominic Abate, would come away with the conclusion that, like, he should have given up the necklace and tried to take Wendell on at Fire instead. Obviously, very easy to say. Once he sees that he loses the jury vote, it's like a complete free roll to take him on at Fire instead if you know you're not going to win there. But I have, over the years, I think, been of the opinion that it is kind of going exaggerated just how necessary it is to make that big move in general and give up the necklace and go to Fire. And yeah, of course, if you are Chris Underwood, you absolutely need to do that. But I definitely think there is still a very reasonable enough path to the end where you can win just by getting the immunity necklace yourself. And another thing that I feel like I've said over the years whenever this question would come up is, you can definitely be the person who, like Tommy this season, gets taken to the end and still wins. I feel like ever since the very first time, which I guess would have been HHH, that we saw this concept introduced where someone is going to be dragged into what, you know, Jamal and the jury seem to openly describe as the goat role, the person being taken because you're viewed as the weakest. I definitely have always been open to the possibility that there are winning timelines from that position. And while Tommy, you know, that type of player being the one to pull that off would not at all have been what I would have expected, I am very much not surprised, I would say, to see this finally work out. And I think this could be another situation where, as we get a bigger sample size, we do see more people win from this position.
Yeah, if you're the person who is favored to win coming in, then all of those outcomes work out in your favor. I guess not the one where you have to play and lose and then you don't have $1 million anymore. But if you play and win, then that's great. And that's the ultimate capstone on your survivor journey. And then if you get taken, then the person who took you just looks like an idiot. And that's another thing you get to say, is that my social game was not only so good that I was favored to win to begin with, but it was so good that I was able to swindle this other person into taking me so that they could then lose to me.
Right. I would be 0% surprised to see a Cerie Fields type win the game this way.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Or a Sandra type. I will go so far as to say that, Dom.
It's weird there, because with Cerie, the hurdle has always been, how could you possibly take someone like Cerie to the end? And Parvati and Amanda have tried, but I think for most, that would be the hurdle, right? Is if Cerie is the massive jury threat that we all like to assume that she would be, then that's still an insurmountable barrier, especially as, you know, she would then have to win and make Fire herself. Whereas, yeah, for the Sandra types, if you have a Russell who wins that final challenge, it's not even like the Parvati's and Jerry's can take that out of his hands if they manage to team up and get on the same page. He can just take Sandra and then that's it. It's game over.
Mm-hmm. All right. So one other thought I had, and I know I was not alone in having this thought, but we see Nora lay out, okay, I'm going to bring Tommy with me. You two are going to be making Fire. So until tonight, you probably want to get practicing. What if they show up there at the vote that night and Nora springs the big surprise, extreme ways drops, and Tommy, who has spent all day not practicing and could theoretically at least be bad at Fire, is suddenly thrown into the Fire challenge? Is that a tactic you think we will ever see?
That's what I thought we were going to see, actually. And I thought he was going to come out on top anyway, but that's how I thought he was going to try and, like, catch him by surprise. And I'm almost kind of sad that we didn't get to see that now.
I would not be surprised at all if we see that someday. I would certainly love to see it. I would hope that it would be well received by the jury. I think that could be, you know, if you feel like you need a resume point, going for a blindside in the Fire challenge seems like a pretty big Survivor innovation.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. So after Lauren loses this Fire here, we see her sit back down at one of the tribal council seats, and the four of them and Jeff have kind of a conversation about her game and what the experience has meant to her. Do we do this? Is this new, or is this something we do?
Oh, where everyone gets paraded. Well, not everyone, actually. The chosen favorites get paraded on the stage to have.
No. Excuse me. I mean at Tribal Council. Like, after she has lost the fire challenge, I was expecting, okay, get your torch and go get it snuffed. But she sits back down, and Jeff does, like, another 3 minutes of interviewing her.
Yeah, maybe this is kind of like something that's always been there and cut for the sake of time, but if anything, the finales are much more crowded now than they ever have been, and yet we still have time to do this. So maybe this is a new standard.
That could definitely be a likely theory, that this is something they generally do and it just doesn't make air. So one just kind of final question from me on Lauren. She certainly seemed like a very solid player in her own right, and I don't mean to diminish from that in any way, but I would say that the big story, not only for Lauren, but I would also say when we talk about Tommy, Lauren's going to be a big piece of that. I think Tommy and Lauren just being a duo, and kind of the duo that defines this season, as far as I'm concerned, will be one of the few things that I end up remembering from Island of the Idols. I know there was a lot going on outside of the main kind of social strategic game, but if you really look at this, there weren't too many spots, I would say, where either one of them was in a ton of jeopardy until it became the very end and they were the obvious threats. Where were Tommy?
Sorry to cut you off there, but that was a point of contention in Final Tribal, right? It's Dean arguing against Tommy that, look, at your Final 10 and then again at Final 8, if we had wanted to take a shot at you, we could have, and it was our decision that saved you. And so that ties back into the classic argument of, yeah, well, I convinced you to save me by positioning myself well in the game, and then that just becomes this snake eating its own tail.
And by the way, when that is the case, the credit goes to the person who did the convincing, not the decision-making.
Yes. But to go back to your actual question there, it felt like that there was always Lauren and there was Tommy, but Lauren and Tommy, or Tommy and Lauren as a unit, only really came into sight pretty late in the game. Whereas some of the other iconic duos that we've seen in the past have been established very early on. And often that was one of the classic editing clues, was if you see this really tight twosome or threesome developed in the opener, if their team ends up taking control, usually they make it all the way together. So you think of like the Kim and Chelsea's of the world, or I guess Rob and Amber might be a timely example to bring into the mix here. But with these two, I never really got a sense of, oh wow, this dynamic duo is teaming up and running the game. It's always, I guess maybe they're in the same alliance. And then when we get down to like 8 or 7, finally we learn that they've actually been thick as thieves the whole time.
So I would say this is a result of a very good thing overall in the Survivor storytelling, which is easing off of the power duo or trio being such obvious frontrunners and so tight from the very beginning. I think there was a lot more kind of episode by episode storyboarding going on here. And I think it was right around like Final 9, Final 8 or so when I really first heard about, oh, it sounds like Tommy, Lauren, Dan, and Janet all feel really good about themselves. But in retrospect, and maybe this is unfair of me, but I am of the belief that it was largely Tommy and Lauren doing most of the shot calling. Is that something you disagree with, at least during post-merge?
I don't disagree with that at all. I just never got the sense that they were fused to the hip, so to speak.
Okay, and that certainly may be fair.
And part of that is that a lot of what we think of as those duos, there's often some kind of power imbalance. Like Kim and Chelsea, for instance, that's Kim, and then she needs a tag-along, so, oh, look, there's Chelsea, right? Whereas it's much rarer to find, like, a Dom and Wendell or these pairs where it feels like it's much more equal in terms of contribution. Whereas Tommy and Lauren, it did feel like that. It seemed like maybe Lauren was, if anything, the more proactive, more strategic one, and Tommy was the one trying to, like, keep the peace and run everything from behind the scenes. But I would have liked to see more from them, precisely because they're these very different, just different people, different characters, different personalities, and also both of them really added something to that mix that the other one was lacking.
So I would say I was very happy if they were indeed the two people really pulling the strings for the most part, who ended up being really tight and going very far together. I am eternally grateful that they were, that we did not see, you know, early on episode after episode after episode of, oh, look how good Tommy and Lauren look. I am definitely of the opinion that the shift that they made in kind of flagging up the ultimately successful alliance way later in the season than they generally do was a very good thing, and I am hoping that that continues to be the case going forward. And I do agree that it probably diminishes from the case that one can make for Tommy and Lauren belonging in the discussion for all-time great duos, or even being a duo necessarily in the first place. Who really even knows at this point? But based on what I am kind of reverse engineering to have been the case over those 39 days, I don't think it would be inaccurate to say that Tommy and Lauren, even if they weren't explicitly like a tight twosome the entire time, played one of the strongest kind of recognizing we both share a mutual interest for quite a while here kind of games together. I don't know how to describe it other than that.
Yeah, I think I see what you're getting at, and I would totally sign off on it.
All right, so I think let's get into some final tribal council action here, Dom. I already mentioned this earlier in passing, but I will reiterate the open jury dialogue where everyone can bring up whatever they want at whatever time as it kind of flows organically into the conversation with the finalists is fantastic, and I wish they had thought of that 20 years sooner or 15 years sooner, however long it took. However, I continue to just loathe Jeff dipping his hands so deep into Final Tribal Council and really laying out, and I would say trying to cement in people's minds, the idea that outwit is one third, outplay is the other third, outlast is the final third. I framed that weirdly because there were three of them, but point being, I hate this. I hate this so much that Jeff is, as far as I can tell, really trying to influence the jurors to care a lot about the things that I don't think they would necessarily be prioritizing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's no kind of expectation that that's going to change, right? Unless Jeff has some personal revelation about the direction of the show and its overall philosophy. Like, this is just a problem that's only going to be getting worse if that's what you think it's doing.
Right. I remember an hour ago or whenever it was, just talking about how juries are adapting to the advantage of the weak kind of era and how much weight they're placing on that. I think it comes almost exclusively down to Jeff Probst putting so much emphasis on that, and that's why it's getting so much play, and would probably not be nearly as much of a selling point in alternate situations where Jeff was just kind of an observer there. But what I guess that's kind of the way it's going to go now when Final Tribal Council is quite liable to get completely out of hand if Jeff is not there moderating it.
Yes.
Yeah, all right. So I guess I've already said, I know, that I thought Dean did a really good job for most of Final Tribal Council. Obviously, a bit of a stumble there when Jamal blew up his spot at Final Tribal with the fake legacy advantage, but got through that all right. What did you think of Tommy, though? Did anything particularly stand out to you as good or bad, or was it just more of Tommy being Tommy?
Nothing really ever stands out to me about Tommy, yeah. Frankly, and that's why he is so, I don't even know if it's so good, but it's good. It's good enough, and that's the Tommy experience, maybe.
Well, I mean, truly the big takeaway from Tommy for me, and he is not at all the first person who has found success on Survivor being this way, but like, boring is totally fine. And I'm not even saying I find Tommy just like watching paint dry. I do find him to be entertaining in some respects, but you know, compared to the average Survivor character, I don't think it's unfair to say Tommy is a little more boring than most. But at the same time, that is going to be super effective on Survivor. If you are just inoffensive and people generally like you, great things are generally going to happen.
It's worse than that. I think that being boring is an added benefit, right?
Yeah.
This has always been the paradox of Survivor as a game and also a TV show at the same time, is that you succeed by not making waves, often by not making big moves, despite what people would tell you, by kind of keeping your head down, being like the second best at everything, not putting yourself out there, which is terrible for TV and a very effective recipe for, you know, inflating your bank balance. And so it is a refreshing rarity when you have a player who is both really good at the fundamentals, but also makes good TV. And that's often, you know, those two things are often in conflict.
Right. I think they are always trying to strike that balance for their, like, winner of the season. And frankly, I think that's what Boston Rob is really good at, is playing a game that's impressive, easy to follow, and well-narrated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. And what did you think of Dean, by the way? Am I overrating Dean's salesmanship here? Because I don't even know if Dean was fully buying into what he was saying, but I think being really enthusiastic about all of his recent accomplishments was definitely the right approach.
Dean is a salesman, right?
I do not know. I realized I don't know half this cast's last name still. It wasn't until like 2 weeks ago that I knew Tommy's last name. Like, the finale was the first time I heard his last name.
Do you know Dean's last name?
Kowalski, but that's because he said it in an episode. I don't know Lauren's last name.
Yeah.
I have no idea what Lauren's last name is.
I guess that is part of the DK brand, right?
I meant to introduce you as DH Chillin', and I forgot.
I can't hear DK without thinking of Donkey Kong, and Dean has nowhere near enough charisma to overcome that for me. But yeah, I think Dean, I believe he's in like tech sales or something, and I would consider buying a software as a service application from Dean. You know, I wouldn't rule that out.
I knew Lauren's job. I feel like she talked about her job at some point, but then I almost thought it was teacher, and I doubt she's a teacher if Tommy's also a teacher.
Lauren is a nanny.
Okay. Close enough.
Yeah.
All right. Don't need to go down that rabbit hole any further.
Not quite sure on what Nora is. I don't know if that can even be defined, really, but I'm sure she's some, like, life coach, grifter, adjacent, you know, so somewhere in that space.
I was going to guess yoga instructor.
Yes.
So, right, you're right in that same ballpark, yes. Any other thoughts just on Final Tribal Council? I will be honest, I wasn't paying super close attention on either of my viewings here, just because it seemed like a pretty big lock which direction this was going to go. But I thought, honestly, all three of them did a fine enough job based on what they had to anticipate going into there. And none of the jurors really stood out to me. Did any stand out to you?
Well, just to finish my thought.
Sorry.
You're welcome. You're welcome. No problem. There we go. So Nora, a few weeks ago, tweeted out a list, like a photo of text that she'd been exchanging with some of the cast members. And like the classification system she used for organizing them in her phone was amazing. But one thing that really stood out to me about those pictures was she has a life coach. And all I want to do now is have a sit down discussion with Nora's life coach, possibly to obtain their services for myself.
Please let it be Dan Giesling. Everything.
Yeah.
Everything is forgiven with Dan Giesling if he is Nora's life coach.
One thing that was a true blindside was Judge Sargent was on some podcast where he said that Nora's ex was none other than Jamie Newton from Survivor Guatemala. Which,
wow.
I can't imagine two people who would seem less compatible on the surface, but maybe it's one of those pairings which actually makes a weird amount of sense when you see it. So, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if Dan Giesling's tendrils were stuck into this pie as well. You know, this is a small world after all.
I mean, I have heard about a lot of weird reality TV hookups. That's high on the list of weirdest reality TV hookups.
That's like some weird fan fiction where just proposing the idea would have someone like look askance at you.
Yeah, that is straight out of Brant Steel.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Nora and just Final Tribal Council here, I do not have, as usual, this exact statistic in front of me. Maybe you could do the math on the fly here, Dom, although I will not require that of you. But I saw, I'm going to guess from Jeff Pittman on finale night, a stat that really blew my mind, even knowing just how lopsided the winners have been gender-wise lately, but not just the final result. Ever since the final challenge, the fire challenge as the final round of eliminations before Final Tribal Council was introduced, it is something like, but not exactly, women receiving in the ballpark of 5 out of like 55 jury votes since HHH. It is very close to single digit percentage jury votes received by women ever since the fire challenge became a thing. Is this an issue of small sample size, or is this the new just standard on Survivor?
Well, I think this season kind of highlights a lot of the causes that go into that, where this was meant to be a woman's season, right? And the fan base at large clung to that hope for a long time, just based on, again, that one comment that Rob and Sandra made. And, you know, so Tommy ends up winning in a final, like 7 or 8, which was majority female, and where it felt like it was either going to be Tommy or one of, like, Lauren, Janet, Elaine, Elizabeth, like it, the contenders from very far out, it was basically Tommy or bust if you were expecting a man to win. Maybe Jamal, I guess, for a bit, but then there was Kelly around the same time. So it felt like this was a stacked female cast and a pretty underwhelming male cast for the most part. And yet Tommy just seemingly inevitably and effortlessly waltzes away with a victory. But you look at the things that go into that. You had, as Dean highlighted, multiple shots in the game where not only other players, but specifically like Karishma could have turned the game on its head by siding with Missy, voting out Tommy, right? Or there are so many moments where specifically the women in the game could have voted Tommy out and they didn't. Tommy, I think, had success because the women liked and trusted him the most. Ultimately, it was Nora who won the challenge and took him to the end. And then Tommy got most of the jury votes Nora got none. All the women on the jury voted for either Dean or Tommy. So it's like, well, to some extent, the cast has to help themselves, right? Like, we can talk about the structural factors and everything that go into it, but ultimately, like, people's actions in the game are going to determine who ends up winning, and if that is going to be the Tommy archetype more often than not. But again, this, I don't know how this conversation changes if, for instance, Lauren's fire challenge goes slightly better, she wins in like some 6-4 vote or something over Tommy. I don't know how the tone of that dialogue changes.
Oh, in what way? Do you feel like, sorry, I guess I'm struggling to even come up with a follow-up question on that. Do you feel in that scenario, so say Lauren wins the fire challenge and then narrowly beats Tommy, what's weird about that to you?
Well, it's not weird. It's that, so instead of saying, we are now on a string of 5 consecutive male winners, and I think it was 5 out of 50-something jury votes. If it's Lauren is the most recent winner, and the ratio of jury votes would still be way out of whack, but it would at least seem like maybe we just had a stretch in the middle there where things went swung one way, and now the pendulum is coming back. Whereas instead now it's, you know, the focus is on Tommy is just part of this trend, which seems like it's going to be very difficult to reverse anytime soon. But yeah, again, like if Elaine or Janet, like if Janet doesn't get nullified out of the game essentially and she wins fire, not only would that be a much happier outcome for a lot of people, but again, that discussion, you know, she would be part of bucking that trend instead of confirming it.
Yeah, I think I am of the opinion that this is largely a small sample size situation. Like, surely the single digit percentage thing will go drastically up as soon as we have another woman winner. But, and there's a reason that we're starting that statistic at season 35 instead of including season 34, because Sarah Lucina got quite a few jury votes. But I definitely do think that it is not entirely a coincidence that since this fire challenge and then since this kind of rebranding, frankly, of what it takes to play a good dominant Survivor game and what is important in casting a jury vote as far as Jeff Probst is concerned, I definitely don't think it is a coincidence that men are on average, having more success there. I don't think it's nearly going to be as exaggerated as it looks in these first five seasons, but I definitely do think that it is not even slightly fair.
Finish the thought.
I don't think it will continue to be nearly this exaggerated, but I think it is undeniable that the playing field has been grossly imbalanced.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything to add to that that hasn't been said, you know, both by us and by other people many, many times already. So, what else is there to really focus on, either specifically with the season or like big picture as we move into season 40 and 2020 and hopefully greener pastures?
Well, where is Tommy for you roughly in your tier of Survivor winners? Who comes to mind as former winners you might be comparing him to?
So this really comes down to how contingent that win was. Like, if he was sitting there hoping for Lawrence Kindling to, you know, not go lit and cost him $1 million, that's very different for me to if he basically had this locked up the entire time and also had, you know, Nora did him the solid of just bringing him to the finals to lock it up. To me, that swing things pretty heavily. And I would have to know, like, what his end game was, who he could be, who he planned to go there with, and how likely all of that was, which I think we would need some of those post-game interviews to really help untangle. So I could see him being maybe like this Aris kind of figure,
mm-hmm.
where in a season of lots of big personalities coming into conflict, a lot of pretty capable players, it's the kind of inoffensive guy who no one has a bad word to say and who maybe he's not everyone's closest friend, but he's at worst their second closest friend. And for some people, he's, you know, the best thing since sliced bread. That's the guy who can just ride it all the way out. But it feels really incongruous to me to say Tommy had this all-time amazing social game when if he would have lost to like three or four people who were there at Final Eight.
I agree with that. And on paper, if you only watch the TV episodes, I wouldn't be blown away if people are comparing him to like Earl or like Kim Spradlin or preposterous.
I think Carl said that he thinks Tommy's the best winner, I think maybe since Kim. It was a comparison he used.
I do understand the comparisons there in terms of he is not making unforced errors, and that is a very good thing when you are playing Survivor, and it's very difficult to do, and a lot of the best players of all time have been pretty boring on TV and just not making unforced errors. And I understand Tommy naturally kind of falling into that camp, but I think I would probably have him a lot like Aris, where yes, he played a really strong game, and of course people liked him when it mattered most and wanted to have his back when it mattered most. But he also got very lucky, I would say, to ultimately come through there the same way. Aris, you can call it lucky if you want to, but there were so many rounds there where if the immunity necklace was not won by exactly him or Terry Dietz, he would have left 100%.
Mm-hmm.
You had to negotiate a lot of that, as did Tommy.
So, hard to tell how well that comparison, or really any comparison, stacks up in Tommy's case. He is as enigmatic as his demeanor would have you believe.
Let me say, very solid Survivor player for sure, as far as I'm concerned. It's just very tough at this hour to put him in the all-time elite pantheon for me, despite not having a lot of bones to pick.
Tommy is one of those people who something has to go drastically wrong for him to ever be voted out pre-merge, really.
Yes.
And when he gets to the merge, he's going to have decent odds most of the time. So even if there's nothing that especially stands out about him or his game, just the sheer likelihood of him being there with a shot is enough to put him pretty high for me.
Absolutely. In terms of just the equity machine, the computer that'll tell us who does the best against random competition as a first-time unknown player, I totally buy Tommy being way up there.
Yeah.
All right. So I guess let's talk a little about this reunion. I didn't, again, think there was a whole ton of note, except, of course, Jeff giving Kelly her opportunity to talk, and we came in here the week before the finale saying we were hoping to hear Jeff tell America, hey, we have a lot of regrets about the way we handled this whole situation, and we would do it differently if we could do it over, and we will definitely have many more precautions in place next time. And that is thankfully almost exactly what we heard. Before you even introduced Kelly, Jeff gave like a 60-second kind of speech to the camera, almost exactly in line with that. So I was very happy to see that be the way that it kicked off. What did you think about this segment with Kelly?
So my sense of the general reaction to this is that big picture, people seem pretty happy with the way that Jeff and production kind of allow that discussion to happen with the one-on-one with Kelly, and the way the finale was conducted as a whole seemed to go well. I know there were some concerns when they said the finale was going to be live to tape instead of live. And, you know, I said at the time I thought those were a little overblown, and I feel justified in saying that now. But it did also seem like the actual segment with Kelly is understandably a difficult topic, and she feels like she's under the spotlight, and it's kind of tough for something like that to go well, right? But it did also seem like she was a little uncomfortable just with the whole setup, and that she didn't really have the ability to prepare properly or maybe guide the conversation the way that she wanted to. Although Jeff did basically say, like, if you, whatever you want to say about this, this is the time to do so, right? This is your platform. So I don't think there's a good outcome that could come out of that, really, but it felt like it went off mostly without a hitch.
Yeah. The one thing I would say that kind of took me by surprise is, and I don't mean to make Kelly sound bad here, but I would have thought that the producers would have her very prepared for, like, okay, this is how Jeff is going to set you up, and you can talk about whatever you want. So be prepared to, you know, you're going to have an open floor here, and whatever you want to get into, you can get into. It did seem kind of weird to me how I feel weird saying how unprepared she was, because I definitely don't mean to blame Kelly for any of this. I think it may have thrown her off just having such an open forum to get kind of such an open-ended setup to, hey, talk about whatever you want to talk about. I could totally understand, you know, given the height of that moment, being totally thrown for a loop there. She seemed very happy when Jeff would interject and ask her specific questions. But overall, I thought the show thankfully did a good job at long last of handling the fallout from all of this. And I am hoping Kelly was able to at least say most of what she was trying to say. And I'm sure there's always going to be plenty more she wished she could have gotten to. But optimistic that at the end of it, most people were happy with the resolution there. Although I have not heard much from the way of, like, people on the street and how they thought all of that played out.
Go ahead.
No, I don't. Go for it.
So let's put all of that unfortunate business behind us now. Let's talk about who we think could be in the mix to come back from this season, because the initial impression at the start was this is a great cast, maybe one of the all-time great casts, and we're really excited to see how all of this plays out. But then the whole Dan thing really soured most people's perception of the season, and it's hard to average that out, right? When you have a cast of 19 that looks like it is aces, you know, front to back, but then you have this one bad apple who's spoiling the entire batch. I don't know how you come out of that with an overall view, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I've heard people say that they may want to, like, just sweep this season under the rug, and I don't believe that at all.
Yeah, if you do that, you lose out on a lot of potentially promising returnees, such as Nora, your queen, our girl, for instance. You know, Janet and Elaine, I think, both could be in the mix to come back. Jamal would be a good candidate. Kelly, I think, has her ticket stamped the next time there's an opening. I think, you know, that there are lots of people on this cast who I definitely wouldn't mind seeing play again. I don't really need to see any of them play again. There are no, like, all-time greats, I think, here, but just the average quality, Hollywood talent agents excluded, is pretty high.
I agree with that. I think that's a really good way of putting it. I'm not going to be heartbroken if Janet doesn't come back, for instance. I very much appreciated what little time I got with Janet, and I'm not going to be greedy, but pretty much not literally anyone, but a lot of the people from this cast, I think, have solid returnee potential, and not just the people you've listed from post-merge or deep into the game. I actually think a lot of the people pre-merge would be really interesting if they ever do any sort of like pre-merge boot kind of returnee season, which who knows? I mean, they're clearly way beyond out of ideas, so why not?
There are rumblings of a second chance, which, you know, I could see some names here being thrown in the hat for that one.
100%. And I'm, by the way, totally down with another second chance. I think after all winners, I have zero, and I mean zero faith in these producers to come up with any sort of compelling theme. So second chance is just fine with me.
It might be, like, I don't know if they would do it exactly back-to-back or if there would be a season in between, but as you say, the climb down from all winners, our most exciting season of all time, to an entirely new cast in the same location with some contrived theme, that would be such a drop-off that maybe they kind of, like, let us down easy by having a less momentous returning player season in the middle there just to kind of ease the landing.
I wouldn't be surprised at all if second chance is better than all winners.
Oh, wow. That's a hot take.
I love second chance season. I think it's perfect when it's all people who have had the exact same number of tries and all have come up short. Mm-hmm. I think that is exactly where you want to be. Or all winners, all people who have... I'm not at all saying, hey, lock it in, second chance is going to be better than all winners, but I will not be surprised at all if that ends up being the case. I think what you want to avoid is the kind of game changers or like fans versus favorites sort of mixes. So I am for sure here for... any sort of second chance season. One other question I had just about this reunion is no little kid vote. Dom, what happened to the little kids?
I don't know. I'm just not going to ask questions and hope that they continue this way.
It did. I listened to a lot of Rob's coverage, and he was there at the finale and in the building, you know, for the reunion and everything. And he said Jeff was... like polling the audience for 7-year-olds at the beginning of the show, and maybe they just couldn't find any that were satisfyingly cute for TV or whatever.
They should have asked one of Tommy's fourth graders and had them say like Janet or something.
Yeah. All right. So I think that's it for me on the reunion. So I guess let's just quickly get into your thoughts on Survivor 39 as a season overall, Dominic.
It started so well, it ended, I guess, not really with a bang, but a whimper, which is the best we could have asked for at that point. And this finale, in a way, felt almost like an attempt to keep it normal and pretend like this had just been any other Survivor season, which I kind of appreciated, and I thought they stuck the landing in that sense, but it did also feel disjointed knowing everything that came previously, so... I don't know. I don't think there's a way to like redeem the season, really, given everything that happened and or everything that they didn't do to address it. But the parts that the cast themselves had more agency over, I think were fine, if that makes sense.
I thought this pre-merge was so good, and it is heartbreaking that one guy really put such a stink on everything that was great for the first half. And I think it was just impossible to overcome that sort of event going forward, especially when not only is it going to get flagged up in a huge way at the merge, but then just before the finale, we're going to pull the guy. We don't want to run the risk of him just like getting dragged to the end and getting any sort of more screen time than we have to give him. I think this was a season that had a ton of things going for it, an incredible cast, a lot of really exciting episodes, but regardless, there was so much that I just want to not think about ever again as being a part of Survivor and a show that I support and, you know, dedicate a lot of time and energy into. I feel bad that it is the case that such a good cast is potentially going to come away with such a bad reputation overall for their season. But at least for me, I don't see myself, as I said earlier, virtually ever rewatching this season. until Survivor is like all said and done. I cannot wait to forget all about it and move on to other things. And it's blowing my mind that virtually none of that is because of the Rob and Sandra theme, which I would say has to at least be in the discussion for all-time worst themes in the history of Survivor. Even not knowing what is coming in the future, I'm positive when this show is all wrapped up, we will remember this as how the hell did we not see it coming that obviously this show has jumped to the shark when these two giant statues are out there.
The thing is, too, is that for both Rob and Sandra, this is by far the worst of each of their sins on any season, almost regardless of what happens on All Winners, thanks to Edge of Extinction. Like, this is going to be Rob's, like, 6 out of 6 for his times on Survivor. For Sandra, it's going to be 4 out of 4. It's almost like a weird... 5? Oh, yeah, 5. Yeah. Wow, yeah. 5, I guess. So it's going to be this weird footnote in their, like, Survivor wiki pages, right? Like, you're going to be talking to someone about Rob and Sandra and their time on Survivor, and you'll just forget about the season, probably, until you're just like, oh, wait, that was there too.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot that I am happy to forget about this season, and I got to go back to just feeling like I feel bad saying this because I really loved this cast, and I would have loved to see them under just normal circumstances playing a regular game of Survivor without Dan and without Rob and Sandra there. But I don't see a scenario where this will not stand out to me as one of the worst seasons of all time.
Yeah.
All right. So, Dom, thankfully, we can put all of this behind us. Survivor 39 is officially in the books. 2019 is in the books. And I still just can't get over that we've spent this entire calendar year podcasting about these last two seasons. But thank God, Dom, All Winners is in front of us. We got an awesome promo in this reunion showing us the 20 hopefuls that are going to be back to win the $2 million prize next season. I am stoked. Dom, how are you feeling?
I'm just glad that this is over, and I feel like we've earned a good season at this point as a treat.
We can have a little good season as a treat. Yeah. So, by the way, in this promo, I've always thought of myself as when I do the Sarah Lucina phenomenal impression that I'm like drastically playing up the Midwesternness of her accent. I don't know what happened in these last 2 or 3 years between Game Changers and now. She has become full-blown Marge Gunderson, kind of like just comically Midwestern accent. It is way beyond anything that I was ever imitating. It's incredible.
It is really good. You might even say it's phenomenal.
Yes. And the other thought that I had just in watching that trailer that I wanted to flag up here is I know we have expressed some both optimism and ambivalence, I guess, about the fire tokens, the in-game currency that is going to be in play for season 40. I know, of course, as a fan of The Genius, that if implemented well, this can be an absolutely amazing kind of twist to include. However, just knowing these Survivor producers, I am nervous that that will not be the case. It did cross my mind, though, that maybe fire tokens could be the solution to all of these advantages just falling out of the sky and being hidden around camp and so forth. I am so much more here for a situation where everyone sees the menu up front. Everyone knows what things cost. Everyone knows what they may be up against any given round, and everyone can approach that tactically. I am gaining more optimism, I guess, about these fire tokens, Dom, and I want to put that on the record. I know this has not necessarily been the most positive episode in the history of the Dom and Colin podcast, but I, despite having major, major concerns about season 41 and beyond, am really, really excited for season 40, and I genuinely do want to get into the back into the positivity zone.
Yeah, that's a good way to end things, I think.
All right, and with that in mind, we have many, many season 40 podcasts already available for your listening pleasure, several of which are up on this main feed that you are hearing this on, and many others also available over on the Patreon feed, where we do close to weekly bonus episodes over at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. There are already at least 12, 15, 18, somewhere in there, hours worth of season 40 podcasts to be had. So if you have missed those to this point, enjoy. And we will be back, I'm sure, soon enough, talking more season 40. But until then, thank you guys who have made it this far. Dom can be found on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. Dominic, any other thoughts for the people before we get out of here?
I'm done. It's been great doing this again. Hopefully better things coming in the future, and happy new year to one and all.
Yes. I guess by the time they're hearing this, it will already be the new year, but that's, hey, that still works.
that is fully under your control. You know, we have a good, what is it? 5.5 hours left. Yeah, there's still time.
It will not be happening tonight. But you can still say happy new year on January 1st or whenever you are hearing this. Welcome to 2020. We will talk to you guys very soon. Take care, everybody.